MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young. Coming up, new numbers today on the deficit. It's soared to $500 billion, due mostly to tax cuts and Iraq.
In Iraq, the International Red Cross decides to cut its staff in half, citing security.
There is certainly a feeling of frustration not to be able to carry out our humanitarian operations with the full speed as we have wanted to do.
Also, Boston's fire department is ordered to hire 4 white men who lost jobs to minorities with lower test scores.
My hope is that with this decision, we can go back to where a person's judged on their score, the content of their character, and not just a box they checked off on the application.
These stories and blazing bright Mars coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. The board investigating the Columbia disaster released its final report today, saying the shuttle accident could have been avoided. The report says NASA mission managers fell into a routine of accepting as normal flaws in the shuttle system and tended to ignore problems that could lead to catastrophe. The report accused NASA of being driven by unreasonable deadlines, working within an outdated, insufficient safety program, and being influenced by politics. The board warned if these persist, systemic flaws are not resolved, the scene is set for another accident. U.S. and Canadian officials are meeting this afternoon to organize a joint task force to investigate last week's massive blackout. Energy Secretary Spencer Abraham says today he wants to be one ultimate finding by a single investigation. NPR's David Kestenbaum has more.
The report lays out 15 things NASA must do before it launches another shuttle. 5 of these had been released previously. The new ones, like a recommendation that NASA work on ways to strengthen the heat shielding on the wings, are unlikely to delay NASA, which hopes to launch again in March or April. The report asks over and over again why no one realized how much damage the foam could do. It concludes that because foam strikes were common, people stopped paying attention. The report recommends that NASA overhaul its safety teams. It also lists a number of other factors that may have contributed to the accident, including resource constraints, fluctuating priorities, schedule pressures, and lack of an agreed national vision for human spaceflight. David Kestenbaum, NPR News, Washington.
A U.S. soldier was killed in Iraq today. Military officials say he was traveling in a convoy when it was hit by a roadside bomb some 16 miles northwest of Baghdad. 2 other soldiers were hurt. In Israel today, witnesses say Israeli helicopter gunships fired missiles near Gaza City, wounding several people. The target of the attack is unclear at this hour. College-bound high school graduates this year posted some of the highest SAT scores in years. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
According to the College Board, sponsor of the SAT, this year's math scores are the highest in over 35 years. Verbal scores are the highest in 16 years. The combined average score, 1,026 out of a possible 1,600. The biggest single jump was 5 points in males' verbal scores, followed by 3-point gains for females in both verbal and math. A record 1.4 million students, nearly half of the nation's high school graduates, took the SAT. About 4 in 10 test takers will be the first in their families to go to college, well over half are female. Most students who take the SAT are white, but there's been a 56% increase in the number of Mexican Americans who've taken the SAT in the last 10 years. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 69.9 points to 92.47 in light trading of 461 million shares. The Nasdaq Composite is down 21 points to 17.42. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stocks on Wall Street are lower today despite some positive reports on the U.S. economy. NPR's Dave Mattingly reports.
The Conference Board says consumer confidence in August rose more than 4 points to an index reading of 81.3. Analysts had been expecting an increase, but not one that strong. They say it reflects the growing optimism of Americans about the U.S. economy over the next 6 months. Separately, orders for durable goods in July rose 1%. That's the second consecutive monthly increase and in line with what economists had been expecting. Another report shows new home sales declined in July by 2.9%. That's due to rising mortgage rates. A larger drop-off had been expected in that June was a record month for new home sales as mortgage rates hit historic lows. Dave Mattingly, NPR News, Washington.
MCI is said to be back on track to emerge from Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection within the next few months. The Wall Street Journal says today the communications company's court-appointed monitor plans to put out a report today. The report is expected to spell out widespread changes on corporate governance after the accounting scandal that led to MCI's downfall. The scandal and the ensuing bankruptcy proceedings wiped out more than $180 billion in shareholder value. The published report says Richard Breeden will say the company formerly known as WorldCom, has made progress in its overhaul and will stay on schedule. Thousands of commuters in Honolulu are having a tough time getting to work today. The union representing public bus drivers urged its members to walk off the job after contract negotiations failed at midnight. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3. The newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at NPR.org.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has released its much-anticipated annual report, and it predicts that the federal budget deficit will reach a record $480 billion next year, more than twice last year's estimate because of increased spending and lowered revenue due to tax cuts. Douglas Holtz-Aitken is director of the Congressional Budget Office. He joins us on the line from Washington. And Douglas, you're the one sitting with the calculator. You know, as these numbers run up, how bad is it?
Well, the deficits that we project in our baseline, $401 billion this year, $480 billion next year, and then diminishing over the next 10 years, are large in dollar terms, the largest that we've seen so far. But compared to our economy, they're not as large as the deficits that we saw in the early 80s. The fiscal year 2004 deficits, 4.3% of GDP, well below the 6% we saw earlier.
What do you take that to mean?
Well, I think if you want to examine the impact of the budget on the economy, you need to, first of all, look at it relative to the economy. How big is it? And then the more important point is that what will the future be? The current deficit is less important than the future path of deficits, and our projections are about showing Congress the implications of current policies if they continue for the future with no change.
Right. As you write, a lot of things have to happen for that deficit to diminish. Before we talk about the future, though, let's talk about what you calculated. Does your deficit projection include the cost of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Our deficit projection follows rules set out by Congress. So it includes, for the future, last year's supplemental spending bill, which covered the costs in Iraq, and it increases it at the rate of inflation. But it doesn't include any particular policies that Congress might take this year to fund operations in Iraq.
You also write that the deficits will disappear, as you said, if seniors don't get a prescription drug benefit, tax cuts expire as scheduled, government spending doesn't rise above the rate of inflation. From your sense of things, what is your sense that the deficit will diminish?
I think that there's a tremendous amount of uncertainty about the future. It comes from two places. The usual uncertainty that we always struggle with, the future path of the economy and events that you can't forecast, but in this case as well from the future course of policy.
We should say you're a Republican, a member of both Bush administrations. You were appointed to the CBO by Congress. But Republicans were very disappointed with you last spring when your office came to the conclusion that the tax cuts benefit was not obvious. How much pressure do you feel now to have better numbers than this?
Well, I view my job as providing the best possible neutral baseline against which Congress can view its policy actions. The legacy and what you inherit when you take this office is one of nonpartisanship and the pride of doing a really good job.
Mm-hmm. You also report economic forecasts, as you say, and the U.S. economy, you report, is poised for a more sustained recovery. But you've also been reported as saying that you're not sure that people really understand the magnitude of what we're facing in the future with programs such as Social Security, for instance. What are you saying about the economy?
I think that you want to take that in two pieces. We think that the economy is, in fact, poised to recover and grow at something close to 4% in 2004, much faster than recent performance and closer to its potential. Even if the economy does that, however, we would expect that the current entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, will rise from 8% of the economy now to about 14% of the economy by the year 2030. To give you some perspective, tax revenues, federal tax revenues, this year will be 16% of the economy. So it gives you some magnitude of the importance of those programs and just how much of the economy they will claim on their current path.
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ifs.
There are an enormous amount of ifs. I think the basic message of the report is that the choices made by Congress and the administration will matter a great deal and that there's a wide range of possible outcomes.
Douglas, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Douglas Holtz Aitken, Director of the Congressional Budget Office.
The International Red Cross has announced plans to reduce its presence in Iraq, citing security concerns. Joining us on the line is ICRC's Delegate General for the Middle East and North Africa, Balthazar Stehelin, who joins us from Geneva. Welcome, Mr. Stehelin.
Yes, hello.
Why has the Red Cross decided, apparently, to pull some staff members out of Iraq?
We are concerned right now about security in Iraq for our staff. As you know, we have been in Iraq even during the war. So we are, of course, used to work in a risk environment. But we have had the assassination of a staff member on the 22nd of July. We have seen a number of very grave incidents, including the bombing against the Jordanian embassy, the bombing against the UN headquarters in Baghdad. And in this sense, we have decided that we have to reduce our staff whilst, of course, remaining.
How much will you reduce the staff?
It's about halving it. We will be overall 40 to 50 expatriate members all over Iraq and, of course, also several hundred Iraqi national colleagues working with us.
Remind us of this assassination in July.
What happened is that one clearly marked ICRC car coming back from the town of Hilla towards Baghdad was overtaken. Shots were fired against this car, and one of our colleagues was killed and another one injured. So it was an attack against a clearly marked ICRC vehicle.
How unusual is it for the Red Cross to be targeted?
We haven't reached a final conclusion whether ICRC as such, as an organization, was targeted or whether it was an attack against all the international community and basically the ICRC happened to be an opportunity target. In this sense, I cannot confirm that we are targeted. But unfortunately, we have had assassination of staff members in different contexts. It's not only in Iraq, and it's certainly something which raises great concern, in particular for an organization which doesn't work with armed protection and has an exclusively humanitarian mandate to carry out.
What will the impact be for average Iraqis, do you think, that the Red Cross will be almost halving its staff in Iraq?
Well, we try to minimize the impact for Iraqis. It is true also that some of the programs which we have carried out during the major military operations, namely in the field of water and health, that we have scaled them down. Because I think we now enter in a phase of rehabilitation where other actors are more important than the International Committee of the Red Cross. So in this sense, I hope that it shouldn't have a devastating impact on ordinary Iraqis.
Mr. Stehelin, a personal thought from you. This must be very difficult for the Red Cross. It must be a terribly difficult decision to have to make. How does it affect the people of the Red Cross, even emotionally?
I think it is, you're absolutely right, an extremely difficult decision always, even to temporarily reduce staff. And the people, some of them actually who were working during the war, there is certainly a feeling of frustration not to be able to carry out our humanitarian operations with the full speed as we have wanted to do. But on the other hand, I think, as I told you in the beginning, there is a need in situations of armed violence, which are situations where ICRC normally works, to be flexible and to be able to decrease and increase according to the security situations. And in this sense, it's not an absolutely, I'd say, extraordinary measure, but something which occurs, unfortunately, in many operations all around the world.
Balthazar Stehelin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Balthazar Stehelin is the Delegate General for the Middle East and North Africa for the International Committee of the Red Cross.
In Boston, the fire department's affirmative action policy was successfully challenged in federal court yesterday when a judge ordered the city to hire four white men who'd been passed over by lower-scoring minorities and further awarded them some back pay and seniority. The city says it's reviewing how the case will affect future hiring, although the judge warned it only affects the litigants because they'd been systematically rejected and the city had made its quota. Sean O'Brien was one of the plaintiffs. He'd been passed over five times and at 36 has also passed the cutoff age of 32 and can't apply again. Sean joins us on the line. And Sean, your reaction to the ruling?
Initially, it was relief and happiness that common sense finally prevailed.
Mm. Let's learn a little bit about you. What did you score on the exam 3 years ago?
A 99.
And why weren't you hired?
Because I was white.
Do they tell you that?
It's not really even the fault of the cities. There are two separate lists, a non-minority list and a minority list that is blacks and Hispanics. And the two lists are merged, and they hire black, white, all the way down.
One minority for every white who's hired.
Yes, ma'am.
Obviously, there were some whites hired in order for there to be blacks to be hired.
Mm-hmm.
So did someone get 1 point higher than you? I mean, how was the white who was hired in place of you hired instead of you?
The majority of the white applicants that I hired for the past 10 or 12 years have been veterans or survivors. Their father was a firefighter who died in the line of duty.
Oh, I see. Sean, why do you want to be a firefighter so much?
It's evolved. My dad was a firefighter. He died when I was 8. So back then, I probably wanted to follow into my dad's footsteps. The need or the desire or the want to become a firefighter has matured as I have matured. And it's really tough to put into words, to be quite honest with you. It's just a feeling.
What are your thoughts, Sean, about being in the center of such a passionate issue that has been politicized quite a bit, and you just want to be a firefighter?
Right. I think you hit the nail on the head. I think everyone who takes that test, black, white, Hispanic, male, female, all have honorable intentions. And the fact that I was not picked and the fact that someone else was picked is really no fault of mine or theirs. My hope is that with this decision, we can go back to where a person's judged on their score, their content, or their character, and not just a box they checked off on the application.
Well, and as your lawyer said, hopefully we're just going back to normal. But I'm sure you're aware, Sean, that that sends shivers to some people, because not to put too fine a point on things,
mm-hmm.
but here we are this week marking the anniversary of the Martin Luther King I Have a Dream speech.
Mm-hmm.
And as I know you know, many blacks could never dream of being a fireman in Boston. At the time of that speech, I think there were less than 10 blacks on the force. So how do you feel about that side of things, that, you know, people are afraid we might go back to that? I mean, do you have any sympathy for the African-Americans who could not get on the force?
I have empathy for the individuals who couldn't get on in 1974, but I'm more inclined to think that was less to do about discrimination and more to do with the fact that they weren't aware there was a test. There was very inferior recruiting processes back then. There was a whole different test. Now the test is pretty vanilla. It's reading comprehension. That's what it really boils down to. And I think if we're all on the same page, I think the numbers will bear out that it's not I don't think it'll be a problem. I know plenty of minorities that I work with now that I grew up with that are bright individuals and that would have no problem doing well on this exam if they so choose.
So you feel the playing field has been evened?
Pretty much.
Yeah. Well, what about, you were saying that your dad was a firefighter. You were saying that you might have been passed by a white person whose father was a firefighter who might have been killed in the line of duty.
Mm-hmm.
And blacks and African Americans and Hispanics might hear that and say, yeah, but I don't have any shot at that because we don't have generations of firefighters. I mean, isn't there still the need to sort of get several generations down the line before you change the system?
I don't necessarily agree with that, because if your father or mother gave their lives in the line of duty, I don't see that it should be marked against you. My father died of a heart attack. His heart attack was directly related to his career. Now, I didn't get any preference, and I don't begrudge any of those individuals who did.
Well, Sean, you're expected to be hired the first time there is a vacancy.
Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that, going to work?
Cautiously optimistic would be a good way to put it. I've grown into a fine young man, as my mom puts it,
mm-hmm.
and she'll still be around to see me graduate from the Fire Academy. And it'll be a good day for the O'Briens.
Well, Sean, thank you.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Sean O'Brien spoke to us from his home in Dorchester, Massachusetts.
Just ahead, the shadow on NASA and the brilliance of Mars.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Inspectors at the International Atomic Energy Agency have found traces of weapons-grade uranium at a nuclear facility in Iran. Joining us on the line from the IAEA headquarters in Vienna, Austria, is Melissa Fleming. She's spokesperson for the agency. Welcome.
Well, hello. How are you?
I'm fine. These reports that we're getting are sketchy. What can you tell us?
Well, it is true that this was one of our findings, that there was highly enriched uranium found during our inspection process. We've asked for explanations of this, and these have been provided to us. But what we need to do is to check out these explanations to see whether there's truth to them.
And we should say this was a report that was internal, was circulated only today, and has been leaked by an unnamed diplomat. But can you tell us, the uranium that was found, can it be used only for weapons?
Well, highly enriched uranium is the ingredient for nuclear weapons. It is also used for research and development. But the point here is that it should have been declared to the IAEA. So this is why we urgently need to get to the bottom of this.
Even if it was to be used for research. Well, what is Iran saying?
Well, Iran is saying that this was a contamination issue, that they had imported some material, some equipment having to do with their peaceful nuclear program from another country, and that the highly enriched uranium traces had been contaminated in that country. Now, we are planning to contact that other country and seek their cooperation in investigating this.
Right. And can you tell us which country it is and whether or not they are allowed to have this material?
I'm afraid I can't comment on what the country is. There are countries who, unfortunately, have not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty and are known nuclear weapon states, and this is a possibility.
Mm. So Iran isn't denying that the material is there. They're just saying, as you said, that it's a surprise to them as well and that it's a contamination. Mohammad al-Baradei, the head of the IAEA, visited this site when he visited Iran. And at the time, he was reportedly astonished by the advanced stage of a project there. And I know you're not prepared to say at this point what the IAEA feels about Iran's complying with rules of nuclear proliferation. But what can you say about how Iran has been cooperating with the inspection process?
Well, what we can say is that the cooperation has improved. We are urging Iran to continue to provide us this access and to accelerate their cooperation and provide us with full transparency. Because, again, there are a lot of accusations out there. There is a lot of speculation. And as this report that was released to our member states today does indicate, there are still a whole number of unanswered questions about their nuclear program that we all need answers to.
Melissa, thank you.
You're welcome.
Melissa Fleming, spokesperson for the International Atomic Energy Agency, speaking to us from Vienna.
You've likely heard of the runner's high. It's the kind of physical and mental rush, a feeling of extraordinary health, well-being, that runners and other athletes say they get from a prolonged workout. But it sometimes seems as though Americans break down into two types of people, those who love exercise and those who just plain old hate it. Well, our regular health columnist Judy Foreman is here, and she's been pondering why some people exercise and others just don't. Judy, welcome.
Hi, thanks.
Judy, you exercise. In fact, you just did a bit of a triathlon, didn't you?
A bit of a triathlon, yes.
There is such a thing as a bit of a triathlon.
It was a whole triathlon. This was the first time I'd ever done anything like that, and I was high for a week. I don't know if it was a runner's high or just sheer joy for having done it, but it was great.
You're an exerciser.
I am an exerciser.
How does exercise work on the body to make you feel good?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, I think extreme exercise, like a triathlon or a marathon or something, may increase these natural chemicals called endorphins. That's kind of anecdotal, but kind of reasonably accepted in the medical community.
What is an endorphin? I hear about them a lot. Well, what exactly is it?
It's a natural opioid, if you want to call it that. It's a natural chemical made in your brain that fits into receptors, opiate receptors, and it gives you a kind of high.
It's a feel-good
like natural
chemical.
Morphine.
Yeah,
it's a feel-good chemical. But that takes a lot of exercise. I mean, childbirth, running a marathon, really big sort of assaults on the body do that. But more important is that moderate amount of exercise can really improve your mental health, your physical health, too. But what a lot of people care about in a way more is their mental health.
Whether strenuous or moderate exercise, it's all very good.
It's all so good. That's why I don't understand why people don't do it. The point I'm like to make is that it's actually fun, and it's a way to take time for yourself. You can do it for all the medical reasons, and you should, but I don't think that message is getting across to people. I think maybe the message we ought to give people is do it for your mental health and do it for yourself, just for getting half an hour on your own or half an hour with friends to take a walk around the block or whatever, that maybe if we stop thinking of it as a should and started thinking of it as kind of a healthily selfish joy, more people would do it.
Well, how could we encourage someone then who says to this advice that they've heard for so long to get some exercise, but it hurts? I mean, I am out of shape. I admit it. And I just can't take the pain that comes with trying to get back in shape.
I don't think you have to feel pain to get a benefit. The no pain, no gain thing is really kind of out the window. I think just starting to move, even in little bits and pieces, according to the federal government, they say, you know, even 10-minute segments of walking. You don't have to do your 30 minutes a day, which is the recommendation, all at once. If you don't have that 30 minutes, you probably have 10 and do that three times during the day. You know, just little baby steps.
It's very much a matter even of life and death, isn't
it? Oh, absolutely. I mean, the medical evidence is overwhelming. If there's only one thing you can do for your health, it's exercise. Virtually every chronic disease can be, the risk of it can be reduced with exercise.
Is it ever too old to get started? Not worth the trouble? You've reached a certain age?
No. In fact, even if you start at age 75, you can add some months to your life. And if you start at 35, you can add years to your life. It is true that those years will be spent exercising, but you'll feel better for it.
Judy Foreman, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks.
Judy Foreman is Here and Now's regular health columnist. To read her latest column, visit our website, here-now.org.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, why black women are more likely than white to die from heart attacks.
And Julius Caesar, a new people's history with a fresh take on the fall of Rome. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, why Columbia crashed, a damning new report that echoes long-time, never-resolved problems at NASA.
And Mars gleams red in the evening sky, closer to the Earth than it's been in 60,000 years.
Usually Mars is so far away that it's a disappointing, fuzzy little blob in amateur telescopes, so it's wonderful to be able to see all of this.
These stories and up-and-comer singer Kyler England coming up Here and Now.
I'm Dave Faniff. The final report on the Columbia shuttle disaster predicts there will be more catastrophes in space if NASA does not change. The Columbia Accident Investigation Board concludes that there are problems with the organization culture at NASA. It says managers ignored safety warnings from engineers and that the agency's attitude towards safety were a factor in both the Columbia and the 1986 Challenger tragedies. Board member John Logsdon says the lack of clarity about how long the shuttle program would last made it difficult to decide how to invest in the program.
The whole system was operating in ways that were characterized by uncertainty, by stress, by tension. It's hardly an environment for effective, safe operation of the program.
The board also says the cause of the accident itself was a breach of one of Columbia's wings caused by a piece of foam insulation that shot free after liftoff. The report made 29 recommendations. It suggests the shuttle return to space at the earliest possible date, with safety at the top of the agenda. Keeping the peace in Iraq now carries a higher human cost than winning the war. An American soldier was killed during an attack north of Baghdad today, bringing the number of U.S. forces killed since President Bush declared an end to major combat to 139, one more than during the invasion and active war in Iraq. The Indian government is criticizing Pakistan in the wake of yesterday's bombings in Bombay. India is blaming the bombings on pro-Pakistan Islamic militant groups. India has often accused Pakistan of aiding these groups and sponsoring cross-border terrorism. Pakistani information minister has rejected the allegations as baseless. So far, no one has claimed responsibility for the bombings that killed 50 people and wounded 154 others. Israeli forces fired rockets at a car belonging to a Hamas fugitive in the Gaza Strip today. One person was killed and at least 16 were wounded. The passengers of the car escaped. An Israeli gunboat also attacked an area north of Gaza City today, wounding 7 people, according to Palestinian witnesses. The Israeli military is not commenting. A weekend fire that destroyed an Islamic center in Savannah, Georgia, has been ruled an arson. No one was injured in that fire, but a rare handwritten copy of the Quran was destroyed. On Wall Street at this hour, the market is off. The Dow is down 71 at 92.46. The Nasdaq is off 21 at 17.42. And the S&P 500 index is down 8 at 985. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Well, as we just heard in the newscast, the hefty report on why the Columbia space shuttle crashed has been released. Although it's 250 pages in length, Accident Investigation Board member Scott Hubbard summed up the cause this way.
In 4 simple words, the foam did it.
Well, we're joined now to discuss the report with Pat Duggins, who covers NASA for National Public Radio. Welcome, Pat.
Thank you, Bill, very much.
Thank you, Pat. As Investigator Scott Hubbard just said, Pat, the foam did it. But reveal for us, how did that happen? These chunks of foam weighed only 2 pounds each, right?
Well, they're 2 pounds, but they were moving at about 500 miles per hour. Remember, when the shuttle launches off the launch pad, it's moving at 200 miles per hour from, you know, from an absolute dead still to 200 miles per hour. So 83 seconds into the liftoff, this large piece of foam about the size of a suitcase fell off and struck the leading edge of the left wing. And even though it's reinforced carbon material, which is pretty tough, it still was able to punch a hole there. And those four words from Steve Hubbard are four words that I personally have been waiting 7 months to hear from somebody.
Yeah, well, what do you mean you've been waiting 7 months? This information was out there for some time about a problem with the foam, was it not?
Well, yes, but it's kind of like we think this may be the cause, or the leading theory may be the cause. Today, Hubbard simply said, as you heard during the actuality during the newscast, the foam did it. That's the smoking gun. That is exactly what caused the shuttle to break up. Not only was it on this mission, but in about 10% of the 70 solar flights that NASA was able to examine had some kind of foam coming off the external tank and doing one degree or another damage to the spacecraft. So this was the soundbite of the day, as they say.
Yeah. Why wasn't action taken sooner on the foam?
Well, that's another one of the criticisms that the independent board sort of came up with, that for a long time NASA simply, well, to sum it up, made bad decisions, according to the report, as far as how serious the foam threat was. As I say, it happened on a number of different missions. Most recently, in fact, an Atlantis flight that was in October of last year. It carried up supplies to the International Space Station, and a piece of foam fell off and struck one of the solid rocket boosters. The board report specifically criticized NASA for not only ignoring basically what happened on Atlantis, but proceeding with another mission, and then Columbia's mission, without resolving what happened to Atlantis to begin with. So it was some pretty harsh words from the board.
Speaking of harsh words, chilling words in this report, Pat, the scene is set for another accident, the report says. What are they telling us?
Well, Hal Gaiman chairs the board, and he basically summed it up this way. He said, speaking to reporters, but aimed at NASA, obviously, he said, NASA, we have been here before. A lot of the different complaints that are being made about the Columbia disaster were made back during the Challenger accident, my very first space shuttle assignment back in 1986. And if those management mindset changes are not made, NASA could very well wind up back in the same boat. In fact, Gaiman says the change in the management mindset that, if you go by the report, ignored the threat from foam, if that's not changed, and it's going to be the toughest change that NASA needs to make, and it needs to be done.
Well, Pat, you've been around NASA for so long. Will the changes happen?
Well, the one concern voiced by Admiral Gaiman is that NASA is going to be raring to go to make every change on the face of the Earth, maybe for the next six missions or so. Now, his pointed concern was, it's natural for bureaucracies after maybe six missions or so to say, okay, we got past that, everything's going to be all right, and maybe a little bit of complacency creeps in there. So one of the suggestions from the Columbia Accident Board is not only to improve shuttle safety, improve NASA's mindset, but also put fixes into the system so that down the road, more complacency doesn't come back to endanger another shuttle and another group of astronauts.
Pat, in the 30 seconds or so we have left, is there any talk out there, why do we need the shuttles at all?
Well, at this point, it's the only game in town, as they say. With the exception of the United States and Russia and perhaps China before too long, there are no countries that are able to put human beings into orbit. Right now, we've got the International Space Station, a massive, though questionable, investment of U.S. tax dollars, and the space shuttle is the only way to get crews and supplies back up there. NASA's talking about a smaller replacement vehicle called the Orbital Space Plane, but that would only carry people.
Pat Duggins, thanks so much for joining us on this.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Pat Duggins covers NASA for National Public Radio and is news director for WMFE in Orlando, Florida.
Well, scientists hope to learn something from the horrific loss of the Columbia, but astronomers say the general public already has. Telescope stores report a general upswing in sky watching after the shuttle crash. People who took space exploration for granted began looking up in wonder and awe once again. And millions will be doing that tonight. That's when Mars is scheduled to make a big splash in the sky, the planet's closest visit to Earth in almost 60,000 years. Joining us on the line is Alan MacRobert. He's senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. And Alan, how big a deal is this in the sky-watching community?
This is a big deal, and this is the big night that is coming up for Mars. It is going to be the closest approach in 60,000 years, but I have to say it's only by a hair, and if it is cloudy tonight, Mars will be, for all practical purposes, just as big and close for the next several weeks.
Well, and people are getting ready. I mean, telescope stores are sold out. People are setting their alarms, and they have been, you know, to get up at a perfect time at night to watch its approach. What are they seeing, and what can we see?
Well, after it gets dark, just go out and look towards the southeast, and there it'll be. It's 10 times brighter, at least, than the brightest stars in the sky. Great big blazing yellow-orange thing. You can't possibly miss it as long as you've got a reasonably good view towards the southeast. And if you wait a little while until later in the evening, it'll be even higher up in the south. And when it's high up is when the best time is to look at it with a telescope.
And, yeah, I understand that if you have a good telescope, people are seeing polar caps and deserts. And tell us a little bit about what people are seeing.
Well, I was out just the other night with my scope, and, yes, the South Polar Cap, this big, brilliant white polar cap on one edge of Mars, is shrinking in the late spring in Mars's southern hemisphere. There are dark markings that you can see on the surface rotating around. These are areas of rock and dark material compared to the bright sandy deserts that cover most of the planet. Mm-hmm. Usually Mars is so far away that it's a disappointing fuzzy little blob in amateur telescopes, so it's wonderful to be able to see all of this.
Alan, take 15 seconds and speak to your people. Is there something that people, you know, astronomers, amateur astronomers should know? Is there a setting or something they should know about their telescopes?
This is easy. No, you don't have to know anything. Point your telescope at it, get it focused, there you are.
Oh,
one thing I should say is don't be disappointed if the first view isn't so great. The big problem with using a telescope on Earth is our atmosphere, which is always full of tiny little heat waves, which fuzz and shimmer and make the view kind of fuzz up. But these change from night to night and even from minute to minute. So the longer you watch, the better.
Mm. And Alan, what is it about Mars? You know, my favorite Martian, War of the Worlds. It just has so captured our imagination. What is it?
Well, ever since telescopic astronomy began, this has been the world that we can see a surface on. This is the most Earth-like planet that we know of in the universe. And for that reason, I think it's for well over a century, it has had this special place in people's minds.
Alan, thank you.
Thank you.
Alan McRobert, senior editor with Sky and Telescope magazine.
Still to come, we meet singer-songwriter Kyler England, born and bred in North Carolina and just maybe on the verge of hitting it big in New York City.
You're listening to Here and Now.
You can now apparently add to the ever-lengthening list of things that you may like to do, but that aren't particularly good for you, playing the bagpipes. A new report in Piper and Drummer magazine contains the shocking new revelations. And now to discuss the perils of the pipes, we're joined by Stephen Dewar, who joins us from Kirkcaldy Fife in Scotland. And welcome, Stephen.
Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
Stephen, how long have you been playing the bagpipes?
I've been playing the pipes since 1985 as a young boy. I'm now 26 years old.
Well, this report in Piper and Drummer magazine says you've kind of been playing with fire. The pipes are bad for your health, bad for your hearing, encourages too much drinking, and pipers become so obsessed with the pipes that it tends to wreck marriages. What do you make of all that?
Well, I read it first in the tabloids this morning. I had a good chuckle to myself when I was having my breakfast. First of all, marriages, yeah, there is one or two guys in the band and other bands that I know that the choice comes down to the bagpipes or the wife. And to be fair, the bagpipes wins every time.
The bagpipes wins every time.
Yeah, definitely.
Hands down.
Any sport hobby that you get into, you've got to go in there, you know, with full commitment to the sport. And it's like sports fans in a way. If they have a ticket for a cup final and the wife says, no, I want you to come shopping, the guys will go to the football every time. So normally the pipes wins in marriage cases.
You know, we see these biographies of heavy metal bands and so on, and their difficulties with drugs and sex and alcohol. You mean bagpipers too?
Well, to a lesser extent, you know, that certainly we don't get the groupies that the rock bands get, unfortunately. You know, we don't get women throwing bras at us and things like that. But to a lesser extent, there is a lot of fame involved with bagpiping. To a certain extent, you do feel like a movie star without the big bucks in the bank to go for it.
I think some young women might want to take a second look at bagpipers, Steve.
Yeah, definitely. There's nothing beats going out there with a kilt on and meeting the young ladies.
Well, if problems with your marriage is one occupational hazard of playing the bagpipes, what about hearing loss? Apparently, this article in Piper and Drummer recommends slapping in some earplugs.
Yeah, I could see the benefit of that in confined spaces. There was actually a study by the EU about 6 months ago that they were actually looking at getting piping banned in Scotland, which was just completely ludicrous.
Banning piping in Scotland?
Yeah, that's what the EU recommended. But as these stories come about piping every 6 months or so, it's the media looking for new stories to report upon. Certainly in recordings and things like that, bagpipers are, you know, fully protected.
Well, Steve, you've been playing the bagpipe since you were a kid. Has it harmed your health?
Not at all. In fact, at my work, we have regular health tests, and my lung capacity is actually 110%. As I say, we are quite fit people due to the amount of piping that we do. I'm sure, you know, if you put any piper up against a normal person in a running contest, whatever, he would fare very favourably.
Steve Dewar, thanks so much for speaking with us.
No problem, Bill. I hope there's youngsters out there not put off by all this and take up the instrument. Wherever they are in the world, there's opportunities available for them.
I hope so, too.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Dewar is a bagpiper playing since he was just a kid, who joined us from Kirkcaldy Fife in Scotland.
Who knew? Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Allow us to introduce you to Kyler England, an up-and-coming Southerner with a voice that is breathless and fragile one moment and pins you up against the wall the next.
Climbing up into the hills, above the clouds, white feathered pillows obscure the view of dirty streets and souls been bruised. Looking out.
5 foot two, with long brown hair and eyes icy blue, Kyler plays the piano, the guitar, and writes songs which, as one critic put it, make you feel that you are ears to the confessions of a good friend.
Must confess, I am not immune to the desire to live up on the hill, communing with the skies.
I grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina, just outside the city, out in the country, and my family had a lot of animals, including horses, so I spent a good part of my childhood in a very kind of idyllic peaceful environment.
And laugh and dance and sing.
If Joni Mitchell or the Beatles or Jethro Tull or Michael Jackson or Stevie Wonder or something along those lines wasn't playing on the record player, we were singing and dancing and just, you know, making up songs. My sister and brother and I were always making up three-part harmony to silly things like I've Been Working on the Railroad, or I remember going horseback riding for hours in the woods. I would be singing all kinds of songs, enjoying the feeling of just singing in the open woods. And I think it wasn't until I picked up the guitar that I realized, okay, I can also write music as well as sing it.
While I've the death proof of a low, breathtaking heights, they'll never know. Breathtaking heights, they'll never know.
Kyler was valedictorian at North Carolina State University, where she studied chemistry and humanities. She then went on to the Berklee College of Music in Boston, following in the footsteps of such famed alumni as Paula Cole, Amy Mann, and Melissa Etheridge. Now living in Manhattan, Kyler is an independent artist, celebrating the release of her second full-length CD, A Flower Grows in Stone. We recently visited the 20-something in her third-floor Brooklyn apartment, where Kyler talked about the new album, her career, and a very special previous release called How Many Angels.
There were five songs that I wrote during my mom's illness and after she passed away. She died of cancer about 3 years ago now. Gosh, getting close to four now, actually. And during that time, it was really the only thing I could write about and the only thing I could think about. And I had to write those songs in order to process the experience and get through it. And I was really actually happily surprised that when I performed them, a lot of people felt connected to them, because, you know, everyone has lost someone they loved, you know, at one point in their lives. And those songs seem to really help other people. So I decided to record them and put them on an EP and get it out there and hopefully help some people with them, you know, help other people with their healing. And I made it also a benefit for hospice. So half the proceeds went to hospice, the one in my hometown that cared for my mom.
It's not because I'd like to forget you or bury your memory deep inside.
The new album is full of songs about all different things, but one of the songs is related to losing my mom, and it's just kind of about being able to close that chapter. You know, not saying that I'm completely done dealing with it, but that I'm at a place with it where I can kind of move on and get through day-to-day life, and it's called Higher Ground.
'Cause when the walls come tumbling down and the waters rushing all around, I gotta
A lot of the alums inspired me to go to Berklee, coupled with the fact that it's really one of the only places you can study popular music. You know, most other music schools, including the music department at North Carolina State University, where I went, you know, very classically oriented. And, you know, classical music is beautiful, but it's just not where my heart is. And, you know, I wanted to be able to study the great songwriters, and I had never heard of Berklee up until my sophomore year in college down in North Carolina, and I heard about Berklee, and I was like, I wish I had heard about this, you know, 3 years ago, so I could have gone straight there out of high school. But I decided to stick with my plan of study at NC State and finish it, and then, you know, went straight to Berklee. Literally, like 6 days after I graduated from NC State, I moved to Boston to start at Berklee because I was just that much in a hurry to get there. I couldn't wait.
Moved to the city at 22, and it's a far cry from where I was born.
I moved to New York City because I was seeking a place that would inspire me more creatively and push me more on the business side. And for a while there, when I got here, I temped You know, just usually like a week at a time or a few days filling in as a receptionist or something like that. And that was tough. It was exhausting sometimes, but it was also tough on the ego, I think. But, you know, you do what you have to do. And then I started transitioning more into touring and being able to make my living, you know, exclusively from my music. And I think New York is definitely responsible for that.
Big city boy, you never known anything more. You got subway lines and concrete highways running under your feet. But what about the cool grass, my big city boy? Come let me show you the world. Out there you might be surprised at how much you like it. For all of my life, North Carolina, you'll always be my home. Even though
the title of the album, A Flower Grows in Stone, comes from the song Something So Beautiful. And that song actually was inspired by a friend of mine. But the idea just being that someone can go through a really hard time in their life and come out on the other side and still be a really beautiful, sensitive person. Something fragile can survive in a really harsh environment. And that's the whole metaphor of a flower growing in stone.
All that you are, all that you've been, all that you wanted to forget. You bury deep when no one can see and hope you can live with the regret.
One reviewer wrote that Kyler England is one hit away from stardom, a distinction that gives Kyler some pause, sort of.
I hear these stories of artists on tour who sleep on the bus all night, and they arrive in town, and at 10 a.m. they have to do, you know, one radio station, and 11:30 they do another one, and they get interviewed by papers in the afternoon, and arrive at soundcheck, you know, like 4, and it can be a very grueling schedule. It's more just like the schedule sounds pretty hectic, but I'm game, you know, sign me up.
Kyler England. Her new album is called A Flower Grows in Stone. Our profile was produced by Karen Pellin. For more information about Kyler and her current touring schedule, go to our website, here-now.org.
The crashing noise, the stinging of hands upon your face. How can something so beautiful come from somewhere so unkind? Yeah, you must have known when you
Here and Now is a production of WBUR, Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories Here and Now.
We'll find out why black women are more likely than white to die from heart attacks.
And Julius Caesar, he wasn't all that bad, says a new People's History on the Fall of Rome.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.